We'll hear argument first this morning, number 96871, State Oil Company versus Barkat Ucon and Conan Associates. Mr. Baumgartner.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The petitioner in this cause would like to accent three questions in this case this morning, if possible. First, that manufacturers and suppliers have a legitimate and competitive interest in the maximum prices which are charged by the people who carry their products. Second, that the rule in Albrecht actually hinders rather than enhances economic efficiency and competition. And third, that the foundations of Albrecht were destroyed by the decisions in Sylvania and Arco. Unless a manufacturer or a supplier operates his own retail outlets, the only means he has for reaching consumers is through retailers. And the activities of those retailers vitally affect the degree to which his products are sold. For instance, in this particular case, Conn's sales were also State Oil's sales. And State Oil had a legitimate business interest in seeing to it that those sales were handled in the most effective manner possible. Any action by Mr. Conn which reduced those sales also reduced State Oil's sales, income, and profits. We believe that this is the incentive which a manufacturer or a wholesaler has when he attempts to introduce a maximum retail price. We also believe that the rule in Albrecht hinders rather than supports competition and maximum economic efficiency because it prevents manufacturers from ensuring that economic incentives offered at the wholesale level are passed on to the targeted consumers who actually determine the competitive outcome. For example, a dealer who wishes a price reduction or a manufacturer who wishes to establish a price reduction are unable to agree, at least to the degree of an enforceable arrangement, that this price reduction will be passed on to the consumer. And the supplier or the manufacturer is therefore discouraged from utilizing price reductions as a means of enhancing sales of his products. A dealer who wishes an exclusive territory or a manufacturer who wishes to establish exclusive territories are again discouraged from utilizing that means because the manufacturer and the supplier are unable to obtain enforceable assurances that the dealer or that some dealers will not ultimately use that exclusive territory to be able to increase the price of the product which they're selling. In this case, when the price ceiling was ignored, the consumer who purchased premium gasoline paid a higher price for that gasoline. And the additional effect of an inability of the manufacturer or the wholesaler to limit the maximum price is that an increased price can be passed on to the consumer. The only thing which the rule in Albrecht really encourages is vertical integration on the part of manufacturers and suppliers. We further believe that the foundations of Albrecht were destroyed by the decisions in Sylvania and Arco. Albrecht appears to be based on four concepts. Number one, an objection to restraints on alienation, a concern about the freedom of dealers, an objection to vertical restraints, and an objection to price restraints in any form. Sylvania rejected the distinction between sales and non-sales transactions and therefore also rejected the concept of restraints on alienation. In determining that some forms of vertical restraints were permissible and were not anti-competitive, Sylvania also rejected the concept of freedom of dealers as an antitrust concept. This leaves as the only real foundation for Albrecht an objection to price restraints as such.
Are there some markets where freedom for the dealers is important? Are there some circumstances in which it's advantageous, and I won't say whether it's pro-competitive, but advantageous to have dealers with substantial strength and substantial freedom?
Oh, yes, there are, Your Honor.
Is one of those instances so that dealers have the ability to switch to different manufacturers, different suppliers?
Well, the dealer, until he's committed to a particular supplier or manufacturer, always has the ability to switch suppliers.
And is that ability helpful to competition, do you think?
Oh, yes. I think it is. It induces a competition between wholesalers or manufacturers.
Do you suggest that that case, Sylvania, totally rejected any interest in the independence of the dealer, such as, for example, fixing minimum prices? Do you think that's at stake in this case?
I don't believe that minimum price fixing is at stake in this case, Your Honor. As I understand Sylvania, Sylvania represents a switch from Albrecht in the sense of looking not at — in Albrecht, the Court, I believe, looked at possible misuses of the activity in question. And in Sylvania, the Court, rather than looking at possible misuses, looked to see whether the activity had potential pro-competitive effects. My problem with the question of minimum price fixing is that I'm not really in a position to express a worthwhile opinion on the pro-competitive aspects of minimum price fixing, and therefore I'm not really expressing any opinion on it at all. It does not apply. Our argument is limited strictly to vertical maximum price fixing. If the primary concern that remains from Albrecht is the question of price agreements as such, it's a recognized fact today that price agreements cannot be realistically lumped into one sole category. There's an accepted difference between vertical price arrangements and horizontal price arrangements. There's a recognized difference between maximum prices and minimum prices. And we believe that
You recognize by whom? Not by our current antitrust jurisprudence.
Even in the decision in Albrecht, Your Honor, the Court appears to recognize that there is a difference between maximum prices and minimum prices, and that's really all I was expressing as an opinion.
I think we can all stipulate that there's a difference between maximum prices and minimum prices, but I thought you were saying that there was a legal difference that's been established in some of our cases.
I know of
not what
no
you're
legal.
Saying.
No, I know of no legal difference between the effect of maximum prices and the effect of minimum prices. I'm just saying there's a realistic economic difference between the two, and that maximum prices established in a vertical sense, as I indicated before, can be used in a pro-competitive manner and should therefore not be found to be per se, as a matter of law, unreasonable and forbidden.
Pro-competitive because it precludes exploitation of exclusive territories. Is there any other particular reason that it's pro-competitive?
Yes. I believe that the most significant position in which it's pro-competitive is the situation, and we believe that situation existed in this case, in which a supplier, in this particular case, to assist the dealer's competitive position, provides a reduced wholesale price, not in one specific instance such as a price war or anything like that, but generally speaking, prices the dealer below what the dealer would normally be charged as a wholesale price. And we believe that the supplier is discouraged from doing that because he's unable to obtain any sort of binding assurance that the dealer won't pass that reduction or will pass that reduction on and won't simply regard it as money on the table, which he can then use. And I think that's probably a more important and more significant instance than the situation in which the dealer has a monopoly position.
That's really your burden. I mean, it's surely not enough for you to say that there's you can conceive of circumstances in which vertical maximum price restraints are healthy. I suppose I could conceive of instances in which vertical minimum prices are healthy as well. I think our per se rule is directed at situations in which it is most unlikely to be helpful. It might be helpful in some circumstances, but the chances are so small that it's not worth taking the risk, and you should put the burden on the other side to show that there's some exceptional situation. Can you persuade us that that's the case, that it's more likely to be good than bad?
I believe I can, Your Honor. I've given two instances, or counting the one that was given, three instances in which it's a good situation. On the other hand, I personally, and it may be a defect in my imagination, but I personally am unable to come up with any situation in which a vertical maximum price arrangement can be used in a manner which will reduce competition.
Well, your opponent here claims
that one situation is where the maximum price on one line, the high octane gas, prevents him from charging a lower price on another line. Why isn't that a situation? I mean, as I gather it, Khan wanted to do was to use the low octane as a loss leader and make up for the difference by charging a lot on high octane. Conceivably, that could benefit consumers. I guess there are more consumers that buy low octane than high octane.
Well, it benefits the consumers who buy low octane, hurts the consumers who buy high octane. Actually, there was no evidence of that ever introduced in this case. It's simply a claim at this point. But I would alter that situation, if I could, Your Honor, to the situation in which we are merely selling high-octane gasoline, and he wishes to use our product to subsidize a loss leader of some other type. In Mr. Kahn's operation, he carried a lot of different products, bread, milk, a number of things. And I think we would have a very legitimate objection and should have a right to protect ourselves if Mr. Kahn had increased the price of all gasoline, for instance, to subsidize a price reduction for beer.
Mr. Baumgartner, are you right when you say there's no evidence? At least it was alleged that that was what the receiver did, wasn't it?
It was alleged that the receiver increased the price of premium gasoline and reduced the price of regular gasoline, yes. There was no allegation that Mr. Kahn ever attempted or wished to do that. And there was no allegation or evidence that the increase in premium gasoline actually, in fact, subsidized the reduction of price in regular gasoline. It may very well have been that the reduction of price in regular gasoline increased sales by enough to more than make up the difference of the lost margin. There's not really any evidence one way or the other at this point in the case.
Although you said you can't think of any example in which suppliers' control of the maximum price that the retailer could sell would ever be anti-competitive, you don't really have to go that far to win, because you can surely conceive of a case in which a seller with monopoly power wanted to drive out competitors from the market and, in order to do it, had to control the prices of his customers as well as his own price. I mean, it's at least theoretically possible.
I agree, and I should have accepted the situation.
But your view is that it happens so rarely that you shouldn't have a per se rule. You should have a rule of reason approach rather than per se.
There are other situations, but they are illegal under other rules. And I'm just simply saying that the rule of reason will cover any situation that could come up in vertical maximum price fixing. If the Court has no other questions, I'd like to reserve any time I have remaining.
Very well, Mr. Baumgartner.
Thank you.
Mr. Klein, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Albrecht should be overruled because its doctrinal underpinnings have been eroded and also because its perpetuation is likely to do considerably more competitive harm than good. Per se rules are reserved for business practices that are manifestly, self-evidently, if not always, at least almost always anti-competitive, whereas maximum resale price agreements are rarely in that category. If anything, we submit, they are more likely to be pro-competitive. For example, as the Court expressly recognized in ARCO, a maximum can constrain dealer market power, which is something that in varying degrees can exist from time to time. These maxims also serve other important purposes relating to price advertising and discounting, which is undermined by a per se rule. I should add, as precedent, Albrecht has had an especially difficult time of it. Its dealer autonomy and dealer multiplicity rationales were undermined in Sylvania, and I do think that that doesn't mean that a minimum falls. The difference is that minimum resale price fixing has entirely different effects, and both pro-competitive and anti-competitive. But it's not the abstract notion of dealer autonomy, Justice Stevens, that's critical here. And I would dare say that Albrecht got a remarkably chilly reception in the ARCO case. The lower federal courts have whittled away at it. The commentators have been extraordinarily critical of it.
Mr. Klein, we have a brief here from 33 states and the territory of Guam saying, don't get rid of Albrecht. That's going to hurt our antitrust enforcement. Now, would you like to comment on the position of the states?
I'd be delighted to. I think there are two things I'd like to say about it. First of all, what's significant is that the states themselves don't cite a single instance, and we in the federal government could find no instances where an enforcement agency brought a maximum case. And that seems to me to be very, very telling. That is, in the 30 years since Albrecht, none of them appear to have brought such a case. Second, their concern, if you read their brief, their concern is somehow if you breach the wall in this pricing area, that you won't be able to stop at minimum. Now, I think minimum presents very different effects. And in fact, their key argument is a maximum could be a minimum. But my answer to that is, if it is a minimum, it will be treated by a minimum. And frankly, I don't see any problem in detection. The notion that somehow you could disguise this, after all, the first person who's likely to object is going to be the dealer. And if the dealer thinks that its price wants to drive his price down, he's entirely free to do so. And if he gets punished for that, then we know that it's a minimum. So this notion that it's undetectable seems to me to be a very hard one to sustain. Now, in addition, the only other arguments, the maximum minimum, which I think is the most telling thing about the state's brief, Justice O'Connor, is they really are fighting for another day. And if that day should come, entirely different competitive considerations will be at play. But the other thing that's very telling about it, the only other argument you see in the briefs is that a maximum price could affect dealer service. Now, that's a reasonable concern, but I would say several things about it. One, there's no reason to think that the manufacturer is not interested in dealer service that has a pro-competitive benefit. This Court recognized in GTE, it recognized in Sharp, that manufacturers have an interest in order to maximize their profit in an efficient distribution system. Second, and it seems to me crucial, is that under the law now, after GTE Sylvania, you can actually impose specific service limitations in your contract. For example, McDonald's can say to all of its dealers, you can't have waiters. It destroys
you
the ambience.
You can't have what?
Waiters.
Waiters?
In a fast food restaurant. They can condition a McDonald's franchise on that limitation on service. The manufacturer here, the gas company here, could say, you can't wash windows. You can't do tires. They can put that in there. Now, that may be anti-competitive ultimately, but it would be tested by a rule of reason. So the notion that we would have a per se rule basically because it might impact service, a price restriction might impact service, seems to me to have the cart way before the horse in terms of what would go on a direct restriction. And beyond that, those are the two generic circumstances, maximum, minimum, and effect on service. Beyond that, the only other notion that comes up is the possibility of predation. And if there is predation, of course, that would be a violation. But the court in Brook and many other cases has realized that that's quite rare. So the key point here is that this is not the stuff of which per se rules are made. Whether you could imagine a case is not the question. If there is such a case and there's competitive effects, the rule of reason is there, as it is for virtually all business practices. What the per se rule is reserved for, what it has its real currency in, is practices that one ought to look at and say, this is really bad stuff. You don't need to do an in-depth examination. Now, what's on the other side of the equation? First of all, you asked about exclusives, but it's not just exclusives. Look at the facts in Albrecht. You can have, if you will, de facto market power. If you're a newspaper dealer, it's really the case that you're going to have an area which you deliver these newspapers to. And unlike the newspaper company, the dealer might well say, look, I have some market power. People in Washington, D.C. want to wake up on a Saturday morning and see their newspaper there. I can charge more than a quarter for that before they're going to go out to a machine or downtown or something like that. And then the dealer can extract real monopoly profits in that situation.
Is one of the state's concerns that if you change the per se rule, then price for maximum prices becomes a legitimate subject of a day-to-day discussion between the manufacturer and his dealers, and that this will create a climate in which minimum pricing and price fixing of the anti-competitive sort might go on, and that it's more difficult than for the states enforced. As is now, it's just this is just beyond the subject of discussion, which is one reason why there have been so few cases on it. People know that you don't do this.
And
if we say that you can, does this then cause a danger of that price will be a subject of legitimate discussion in some instances, and that this will lead to abuses? Is that
It may be the state's concern. I don't think it's a realistic concern, Justice Kennedy, for several reasons. To begin with, there is a lot of discussion about price, as this Court has recognized time and again. You can have a suggested manufacturer's retail price as long as there's no agreement, but they discuss it all the time. Second, it seems to me this notion that somehow talking about this issue will lead to unlawful agreements, I think, if there is such an unlawful agreement that results, then we can address that problem in that particular case. But I don't see any reason to somehow say that we need to eliminate from the air discussions of price. Manufacturers and their retailers discuss price all the time.
Mr. Klein, what about the principle of stare decisis here? We're dealing with a statutory question, not a constitutional question, and customarily it takes a fairly strong case to get us to overrule a previous decision.
I think that's right, Mr. Chief Justice. I would say two things. One, I think, as this Court has recognized, the standard under the antitrust laws is a little different from many statutes because it is a common law statute in which this Court has revised and changed over the years. GTE Sylvania said that, and the Court did as well in Copperweld. And I think it's recognized that principle. But I think whatever standard you apply, it can be met here. I think if you look at GTE Sylvania, you will see that the basic notions that animated the decision in Albrecht are no longer viable. There was a view in the mid-'80s that actually animated Schwinn, in the mid-'60s that animated Schwinn and animated Albrecht, that said there ought to be dealer autonomy, we ought to have lots and lots of dealers, that's better than a few dealers. The Court's opinion quite clearly eroded that thinking. Not only that, it created the very right to establish exclusives that Albrecht said was no good. Albrecht said, well, if you have market power because you have an exclusive territorial arrangement, then under Schwinn, the territory falls. But now, post-GTE, the territory remains. Then I think the next problem you have is, Court says in ARCO, it's really an interesting opinion. It starts out by saying, we assume arguendo that Albrecht is still good law. It then has a footnote saying, Albrecht was the only case ever that dealt with a pure maximum. And then it goes on in footnote 13 and says the pro-competitive benefits are now, quote, clearer than they were at the time of Albrecht. And they cite a list of maybe 10 different academic articles, all of which are harshly critical of Albrecht for essentially misperceiving its competitive impact. Then you look at what the lower courts have done. They have constantly read the opinion narrowly, chipping away at it. No antitrust injury, no injury in fact, no damages, no agreement. Cases involving discounts get distinguished in some sort of ways. So this is anything but robust. This is, Chief Judge Posner's words, a rather moth-eaten foundation. And then the point which I would not discount, Justice Kennedy said there haven't been many such cases. In minimum resale price maintenance, the states cite a lot of cases they have brought. The Antitrust Division has brought such cases. The Federal Trade Commission has brought such cases. These are real enforcement actions. In the maximum area, there are no such cases. It's not because the practice doesn't occur. It's because government agencies don't find this to be a desirable enforcement vehicle. And then I would just say the last point, to the extent congressional intent here is relevant, of course, in 1991, Congress actually attempted to pass — it ultimately failed, but a different statute passed both houses, trying to reverse this Court's decisions in Sharp and Monsanto. And while the ultimate statute never passed, Mr. Chief Justice, both statutes would have ensured — both bills would have ensured that minimum resale price maintenance stayed a per se rule, and they had exceptions for maximum. So to the extent one can take anything from that congressional reaction, Congress, too, realized that Albrecht was no good.
Of what use is congressional reaction if it doesn't become a law?
I only point to it. I put it last on the list. I only point to it to say to the extent we heard anything from them, we've heard that what little guidance there is minimal. I agree. But the key point is not what Congress did. This is, in the end, a common law statute. This Court, I believe, has the obligation to revise and change in this circumstance. And the reason you should do it, most importantly, is I don't think you should strip manufacturers of a mechanism that is pro-competitive. If we leave it on the books, that is going to increase market injury, and I think that is a bad result. Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Mr. DiVincenzo.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Current antitrust jurisprudence relies upon interbrand competition to guarantee the fundamental purpose of the antitrust laws, the protection and preservation of competition. What I find interesting in this case is that although cloaking themselves as champions of competition, their position, the government and State Oil's position, really expresses a deep-seated distrust of interbrand competition. Look at what they tell you. They tell you that we need to have the manufacturers and suppliers, the upstream suppliers, have power to set prices because interbrand competition, which affects and controls retailers' actions as well, isn't going to work. We have to be afraid of the possibility of retailers having market power. What happened to the concept of interbrand competition, which they espouse? If interbrand competition exists in a marketplace, why not trust interbrand competition to keep the prices of the retailers at the level that competition would, in fact, dictate?
I guess their answer is that basically the only time that a manufacturer would want to do such a thing, not 100%, but the best, would be in an instance where interbrand competition was not working perfectly. Otherwise, there wouldn't be power in the dealer to raise price above the competitive level. That's why he wants to keep it down. There isn't enough interbrand competition. I think that's basically the argument.
In 30 years since Albrecht was adopted, what I'm looking for, and I don't see in this record or in the literature, is any breakdown of interbrand competition controlling retailers. As this Court itself pointed out in the Sharp case, it is rare indeed that you're going to find a retailer that has market power to be able to dictate price. And indeed, the concept of GTE Sylvania was that you don't have to really worry about exclusive territories because they protect intra-brand competition, because you still have the specter of inter-brand competition out there to control these retailers, even though they now have exclusive territories. Under those circumstances, I think the best way to approach the potential problem of a market power in a retailer is under the current jurisprudence. And that has two very distinct elements. The first is Albrecht, which is the per se application. It says that a violation of Section 1 occurs when there is a vertical maximum resale price maintenance agreement, price fixing at that level. But there's a second element, and that is the ARCO case. And the ARCO case says that in order for a private plaintiff to have an antitrust cause of action, that private plaintiff has to establish an antitrust injury. And it is an injury which flows from the core of the antitrust laws. And what is the core of the antitrust laws, as this Court has come to define it? Interbrand competition. So thus you have the per se rule in its maximum strident position, indeed.
Sorry, I thought you were talking about intra-brand. You mean inter-brand?
Inter-brand.
Oh, well, the reason that there were is that they have some market power in their product. And since they have some market power, the price isn't perfectly competitive. The dealer gets more market power because of his position. That's why they want to keep the price down.
Again,
and that's the basic argument, which I guess you'd have to deal with.
I understand it.
I'm sorry I misunderstood you.
No, what I'm saying is that in a situation, the best way of dealing with that market power is to use the per se rule coupled with antitrust injury. It would require a plaintiff to demonstrate that there was an injury flowing to itself from the interference with inter-brand competition. And that's what occurred in this case. Here, Mr. Kahn ran his gas station, and he was constrained into his pricing ability. He had to deal with a margin restraint, which is a slightly different animal than a pure maximum price-fixing price. It says, Mr. Kahn, you cannot make more than 3.25 cents per gallon of gasoline. Now, we don't care if you charge more than the suggested pump price, even to monopoly levels. But we get those monopoly profits. And that's State Oil's position here. It's clear that State Oil wasn't trying to restrain Mr. Kahn's ability to charge monopoly prices. All they wanted to do was shift the profits from that monopoly pricing, if it could occur, from Mr. Kahn.
But surely the effect was precisely the same. If you tell a dealer that you can charge whatever you want, but everything over a certain amount that you take in goes to me. He's not going to do that.
I don't really think they thought Mr. Kahn was that stupid.
I certainly agree, but I think, Your Honors, what that puts an end to is the argument which State Oil makes that what they were trying to do was constrain, in reality, Mr. Kahn's pricing. I don't think that that was what was involved in this case at all. The intention here may have been to allocate the profit margins, but it certainly wasn't any concern over Mr. Kahn's ability to manipulate or charge more for gasoline than interbrand competition, which existed in this marketplace, would allow him to charge.
What's the antitrust injury? How is the consumer harmed?
The consumer was harmed here because the price which was in fact set, the mechanism, the restraining mechanism, the margin restraint, affected both a maximum price on some products as well as the minimum price on other products. Indeed, what you ended up here is the manufacturer set a single price, and that became the market price, because it not only eliminated the ability of the dealer, Mr. Kahn, to increase price. He removed any incentive, as this Court has just pointed out to me. It also eliminated his incentive to decrease prices, because at this point, at 3.25 cent margin, his margins were so close to cost that he had no incentive or ability to lower the price.
Why does he ever have an incentive to lower the price? I mean, once again, doesn't this posit a good deal of stupidity on his part? That, if I could only raise this price more, I would give all this money back to the consumers by lowering my price on the regular gas. Well, I mean, no, nobody behaves that way.
Your Honor, with all due respect, the receiver behaved exactly that way after Mr. Khan was out. When Mr. Khan left the station, the receiver did exactly what we say State Oil constrained them or stopped them from doing. It lowered the price on regular grades of gasoline, and as the expert points out, that resulted in a shift of the volumes from premium to more sales of regular gasoline, thereby increasing the volume of sales. And the same token, there was...
Excuse me, but by that do you mean that some people who used to buy premium bought regular? Or
no.
More regular were... More people came to buy regular.
Your Honor, with all, based on the record we have, all we know is that there was more regular gasoline sold.
Okay, well, that in itself is a justification for lowering the price of regular gas. And as far as I can tell, it's the only justification that someone who's selling gas will ever use. If I lower the price, I'll sell more and I'll make more money. I can't imagine anybody thinking, oh, you know, if I could raise the price on premium, I'll be able to lower the price on regular even though it won't get me any more customers. I mean, that's silly. Why does he want to do that? This man is full of love for gasoline buyers?
No, Your Honor. What this man is trying to do is run a business where he has his margins constrained at 3.25 cents per gallon, which is simply, as experience proved to him, not enough to sustain his business. So what he attempts to do at that point is by using his market ability to read the market, to get to a level which brings him more volume and therefore some additional gross revenue.
Right.
But at the same token, add to his profit by charging what the market allows him to charge as a competitive price on another grade of gasoline.
But he ought to lower the price of his regular no matter what the price of his premium is, if lowering the price of the regular will increase his profits. He ought to do that whether or not he can fiddle with the maximum on the premium. I can't understand why that gives him any more of an incentive to lower the price of his regular.
The incentive that any dealer has is to stay in business, Your Honor.
No, it's to make as much money as he can.
And if by lowering price he cannot make enough money to stay in business?
No. By lowering price he can't make more money than by keeping the price higher, he's not going to lower it. He's not going to say, I'm going to lower it, I'll lose a little more. You know, I'll make it up by increasing my premium price. That is senseless behavior.
Your Honor, no, I don't believe it is. And for this reason, as a businessman sitting there, he must decide whether, in fact, the lowering of the price in the competitive conditions that he faces will result in an increase in volume to him and bring in sufficient additional revenue to offset the decrease in price that he has, in fact, imposed.
This is intelligent behavior only for somebody whose whole objective in running a gas station is barely to stay in business. That then it makes sense. If I'm going opening this gas station in order barely to stay in business, then I might want to raise my premium price so that I can give away money by lowering my regular price, even though it's not going to increase sales.
And it is also the
I don't know anybody who has that objective. He wants to make money.
Your Honor, he must make money. But it would also be the case of someone who is in trouble of going out of business to adopt that marketing strategy and that pricing strategy. Because if that person is then faced with a business where he is about to lose his $100,000 investment in his gas station, he's got to do something to increase his profitability. He's got to make more money. So at that point, he says, I can get more volume and thereby increase my ancillary sales, drawing in additional revenue. But at the same token, that is a tremendous gamble, and one which he may say, given the current market conditions, he could not achieve. If he lowers the price and doesn't increase volume, what he's done is sign his own death warrant. But in the circumstances that existed here, because of the pricing decisions imposed upon him by State Oil, the market for premium gasoline, the interbrand competition on premium gasoline, would allow him to make more money. And so as a result, he would be able to shift his pricing to lower the price one place, to increase his overall volumes, and the same token to increase the price on premium gasolines overall, increasing his margins.
The 3.25 limit did not apply to premium?
The 3.25 limit applied to all grades of gasoline.
All grades of gasoline.
He was restricted with that margin. He could not charge another price. If he did, it went to State Oil. If he dropped below, he lost money.
If I understand your response to Justice Scalia, it would be that lowering the price of the cheap grade will make him more money. but not for a year or two. So we have to stay in business until it pays off. And so what we'll do is raise the high price even more, and that gives us the money necessary to stay in business until the low price pays off.
That would certainly be rational thinking.
Is that your argument?
Yes, that would be rational thinking.
And the problem with that argument, I guess John D. Rockefeller could make it too. Let me, any monopolist, let me charge the earth, because you see, what I do when I charge the earth is I take all this money, John D. Rockefeller and others, and I give it back to the public. I charge a lower price eventually for my heating oil or for some other product. And the difficulty is not that that's always wrong. I guess the difficulty is if that argument were allowed as a response, it would always be made, and we'd never know when it was wrong. I mean, that's what I think. You gave a sophisticated argument, and so I think it's an interesting one, and I want to get you to respond to what I'd call as a real administrative objection to your sophisticated argument.
The argument can always be made by a monopolist with market power that what they're trying to do is shift pricing around so that at one point they in fact lower price. I don't think that makes a monopolist, going back to United Shoe Machinery, this course was faced with the benevolent monopolist. You can always posit a benevolent monopolist, but that still was considered illegal. What I think the administrative answer, Your Honor, is that the rest of the antitrust laws aren't abrogated as to dealers. The antitrust laws would apply to dealers who attempt to use or abuse monopoly power that they have acquired in a definable marketplace. And that's the other end of this scenario. You have on one end, in trying to judge whether you should change the per se rule and allow vertical maximum price fixing, the question is it really necessary? And I suggest that it's not, because interbrand competition should do in all cases where interbrand competition exists and is not distorted. It should keep the prices at competitive levels, so you don't need to have this artificial restraint or power given to manufacturers where interbrand competition can work.
But it apparently doesn't work here, because you say your client feels free to kick the premium up as high as he likes without being — why isn't he constrained by other gas stations from charging this additional money for his premium?
The answer, Your Honor, is that in the given conditions, the price that was be prevailing in the marketplace must have allowed him to make additional margin.
That is to say, there was no interbrand competition.
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor, with all due respect. Interbrand competition doesn't always drive the price to the lowest possible level. Otherwise, you'd have no profitability. Competition sets a price, and I think this Court has recognized.
Well, is it your position that the market for the premium gas generally allowed for a margin of more than 3.25 cents, whereas just 3.25 on the regular? In other words, the difference in product should have dictated a difference in margin, and that's what he was trying to take advantage of.
That is correct, Your Honor. The difference in the products, there are, without using the term market in the technical sense, but the difference in the competitive market for premium gasoline would allow a higher margin. And a competition within that market would have allowed the dealers to make more than 3.25 cents per gallon. The receiver experienced at least 3.8 cents a gallon overall his entire product margin. On the other hand, because of the difference in the nature of competition, it may be that premium gasoline buyers don't price shop as much as regular gasoline purchasers, but that the general circumstance concerning regular gasoline is that the margins, the competitive market, allows less margin and requires lower prices. And what State Oil did was said, ignore the competitive circumstances, ignore these differences between these products, and set a single price.
And of course, the consequence of that normally would be that you would get a larger share of the premium sales if your margin is less and you'd be underpricing your competitors on premium.
You might receive some additional...
Unless, as you say, all premium buyers are stupid.
Well, not necessarily stupid, less price
they
elastic.
They don't.
Demand being in that market a little different, the elasticities of demand being different. But under those circumstances, what you end up happening is, what ends up happening is that you have State Oil saying to this court, give us the power to put our judgment in place of free market forces. And that is a very serious threat to competition, which is the purpose of the antitrust laws.
Well, free market forces are ordinarily reflected in contracts, which your client signed with State Oil.
There was a contract that was signed with State Oil in which he agreed. That's how we actually get in under Section 1 here, Your Honor. There was an agreement which constrained his ability to price to 3.25 cents. There is the other flip side of that, however, is that what is not set is the pump price. There's no contractual requirement that a particular pump price be set. So State Oil had the right to set a pump price, and that pump price may or may not reflect conditions in competition in that particular marketplace. And if State Oil guessed wrong, then you have the threat of anti-competitive effects. And if State Oil, as it did, guessed wrong as to the price that should prevail for regular grades of gasoline, you have the consumers being hurt. And State Oil guessed wrong on the high side, on the premium grades in setting the maximum, then Mr. Kahn was squeezed at that end as well. This was a squeeze that came from both ends and ultimately resulted in his failure to run the business. Now, the receiver, which refused to agree with the restraint set forth in the contract, was free to do what it wanted and adopted a marketing strategy which increased volume, which increased profitability and margin, and therefore benefited some consumers, benefited State Oil, as well as benefiting itself in the operation. And that's what competition is supposed to do. Competition allows for the businessmen to make a reasonable profit so they can stay in business, so they can invest in their business, to recoup their investment. And that return of investment is
important. I don't see that any of that argument means you couldn't reach the right result under the rule of reason. I mean, I just don't understand why it requires a per se rule.
The rule of reason analysis requires proofs of market power, quite honestly, which would exclude almost every single petroleum market case that you face with, as well as others. Absent proof of market power and impacts on competition in a definable market, you would have situations like Mr. Kahn not being able, you could not address his situation where he suffers an antitrust injury. But moreover, when the...
Excuse me, he suffers an antitrust injury. I mean, that I thought it's the consumer that suffers the antitrust injury.
No, in this case, he suffers an antitrust injury in the sense that he cannot price and increase his volumes on the low end and make a competitive price on the high end.
I think we've said that the antitrust law is not there to protect merchants. It's there to protect consumers.
In every case,
and that's why I keep looking for some consumer who's been hurt by this. Now, you say when the trustee took over, he lowered the price of regular. Is it clear that it would not have paid him to lower the price of regular unless he had increased the price of premium? Did he not make more money in volume by lowering the price of regular?
He made some additional volume. He made volume. There's nothing in the record which indicates he made enough from that to be able to sustain or improve the profit.
Is there anything in the record to the contrary, that he did not increase his profitability by selling more of the regular at a lower price? Do we know that he lost money on it?
No. The only evidence in the record is the expert's report, which, as I pointed out, indicates an increase in overall volume, lumping both all grades together.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. So I think you've answered the question. Ms. Harbor, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. For several decades, the 35 state attorneys general before this court today have been the primary enforcers of the law in the area of vertical price fixing. Our experience and the realities of the marketplace have shown us that the labels placed on these agreements, that is to say, maximum vertical price fixing on one hand and minimum vertical price fixing on the other, are in most cases a meaningless distinction. As the agencies most familiar with these cases, the states have considerable experience with price-raising schemes being characterized as price-lowering schemes,
Ms. Harber, how extensive is that experience? Is it correct that there's not a single case that's been brought?
Your Honor, there was a characterization game that was going on here. The targets of our investigation came in and said to us, we are actually fixing price ceilings, intending to lower prices. But in fact, after we investigated, we found that those were not price ceilings. In fact, they were intended to raise prices rather than lower them.
So were there prosecutions brought? What I'm asking is it correct, as the United States government has contended, that they're unaware of a single case where you or any other state has moved against maximum prices?
As I said, there are elements of maximum price fixing in the cases that we brought. The states claim that
they're pricing. What cases are they?
The Minolta case, it was a $640,000 settlement that was returned to consumers. Panasonic involved a $16 million settlement. And in these two cases, as well as Mitsubishi, Your Honor, the defendants contended that they were actually trying to lower prices for consumers. But in fact, when we investigated, we found that they were, in fact, raising those prices. There was a characterization. They were appealing to our prosecutors.
We found that they were minimum pricing cases, not maximum pricing cases. And I suppose the question is a genuine maximum, which is not in question in this case. No one is asserting that this was a minimum price in disguise. Do you have any case where there was a maximum price, not a disguised minimum price, where the states have prosecuted?
Understood, Your Honor. No, Your Honor, but retailer market power is very rare in these cases.
The reason that I think that's awfully important is because what you're basically doing is you're taking the position that consumers should have to pay more money for gasoline. Now, if you're requiring consumers to pay more money for gasoline, there ought to be, which is what's going on, if you don't let them set a real high price, then I'd like to know why. And your argument is because really, maybe it's a minimum price. All right, I understand that argument. It's logically sound. But what is the evidence that you have to make consumers pay more money for gasoline in order to stop people from, you know, charging a minimum price? And that's why I think this evidentiary question, why you know that, why you're saying this, the facts of the case are pretty important. So I'm urging you to, you know, why do you think that?
Your Honor, basically the argument being advanced today by the petitioners is that manufacturers like State Oil should be free to restrain the exercise of monopoly power by their dealers who have been granted exclusive territories. Well, first of all, Kahn had no exclusive territory. There is nothing in this record that points to that. And second of all, nothing in this record suggests that Kahn had monopoly power whatsoever.
That's quite a good point. And do you think, then, it would be possible under a rule of reason for a firm to come and complain on the basis that they're a failing dealer? And so a failing dealer couldn't possibly be in a situation of trying to raise prices above the competitive level, unless there was no need for this kind of thing to constrain his price. I mean, that's what I think would be quite interesting, whether there would be categories of things where it would be a good defense or would be a good price-fixing claim.
The rule of reason is not the rule for a price-fixing case or any agreement on price. In fact, as this Court has held in Maricopa, the anti-competitive potential inherent in all price-fixing cases justify their facial invalidation even when pro-competitive justifications are offered for some. But in this case, Your Honor, it is the State's position that the argument posited by the petitioners is illogical, and allow me to illustrate. The petitioners have hypothesized a dealer with market power in an exclusive territory. When a dealer has monopoly power, by definition, there is no effective interbrand competition, and therefore, there is no justification for granting the exclusive territory. Under the Sylvania decision, Sylvania held that restraints on intrabrand competition, namely the exclusive territory, will only be tolerated when they stimulate interbrand competition. But here, this dealer, this hypothetical monopoly power that this dealer has, there is no effective interbrand competition. Therefore, there is no justification for granting the exclusive territory, and further, there is no justification for imposing the price ceiling to restrain the monopoly power that was unreasonably granted to the dealer in the first place.
Gee, is that our law? I wasn't aware it was. You cannot have exclusive territories, even though exclusive territories overall will stimulate interbrand competition. If in any single territory there's no interbrand competition, you cannot restrict that dealer to a territory?
As the holding...
Just one territory?
Intra-brand competition, restraints on intra-brand competition will only be tolerated when they stimulate inter-brand competition.
Within the particular territory or overall? I mean, I'm a manufacturer, and nationwide, there's plenty of inter-brand competition. But you're saying if there's one territory in the country where there's no effective interbrand competition, you cannot have an exclusive territory there.
When I'm talking about a monopolist, and when there is a monopolist, that means there is no inter or intra-brand competition.
I wasn't aware we'd held that.
You think that's the law?
Your Honor, if I've mischaracterized that, forgive me, but I do know that in Sylvania, this Court said that in order to restrain intra-brand competition, there must be effective intra-brand competition, and the states do not feel that that has been posited here. But we do believe that a great deal is at stake in this case, Your Honor, more than the 29-year-old rule in the Albrecht decision. The clear and straightforward per se rule against maximum price fixing, which has served this nation well for most of this century, is at risk. Albrecht was merely a reaffirmation of Dr. Miles, Saucony Vacuum Oil, Park Davis, and many other precedents in a consistent line of cases which all stand for the same proposition, that price fixing is price fixing, whether it is vertical or horizontal.
And why was it takes Dr. Miles was 1911 and Albrecht wasn't until the 60s, so if it was so evident that minimum and maximum are the same and they're all equally bad, why did it take from 1911 till what, 1968? For that light to dawn?
Actually, it didn't, Your Honor. In 1911, Dr. Miles equated horizontal and vertical price fixing, and basically they said that it produced market effects that were functionally the same. But then in the Saucony vacuum oil decision in 1940, this Court formulated the classic definition of a price fixing agreement: any agreement that fixes, raises, lowers, maintains, or stabilizes prices. In that agreement, maximum and minimum price fixing was equated.
That may be, but they're arguing for a very basic distinction. In the vertical context, the one means the consumer pays low prices. In the other, high prices. Where the consumer pays high prices, that's likely to be bad. Where it means the consumer pays lower prices, that's likely to be good. I mean, that's a crude distinction and requires lots of, but I mean, I think that's the basic idea, isn't it, for making the distinction between the high and the low under the antitrust laws?
Yes. In the state's opinion, price ceilings almost always harm consumers, and they almost always harm consumers because they can disguise a minimum price, as this Court pointed out in Albrecht and later in Maricopa, or they could be a de facto minimum. And also they can facilitate collusion. And as this Court pointed out in...
Can't you use suggested retail prices for that purpose just as effectively?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why can't you use suggested retail prices for that purpose just as effectively?
Well, in fact, that is...
I mean, if you're trying to get a de facto minimum.
I believe that that suggestion by Your Honor is an alternative that can be used instead of the price ceiling. Price ceilings are almost always anti-competitive, and there are alternatives that are less pernicious to competition, such as suggested
retail prices. Thank you, Ms. Harper. Your time has expired. Mr. Baumgartner, you have 1 minute remaining.
We have nothing further, Mr. Chief Justice.
Very well. The case is submitted.